So the session this morning, we have two plus three presentations with a break in between. So we had announced two keynote lectures, one in the morning by William Nordhaus, and the second one is by Michael Greenstone from University of Chicago. So I understand it will be a follow-up of Maureen's presentation this morning. Okay, Mike. So you have 1 hour, so if you can keep 10 minutes for discussion at the end, that would be perfect.
Terrific. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk here today at the culmination of your year of leadership here, with such a terrific group of people here. I'm honored to be among them. So I'm going to talk about, and this builds, as Maureen was going through her talk, not sure if she's back from lunch yet, but there's some overlap, and so I will try to zoom past the parts that were clearly overlap. What I want to talk about in general is some work that I've been co-leading with a couple colleagues to empirically found our understanding of what the damages from climate change will be as much as possible. And then to build into that and build in a lot of the work of people in this room and others, how to value those damages, and with a particular focus, of course, on the social cost of carbon. So I always think it's useful just to level set on where the world is. So the world is through the blue line, and then we have some scenarios of what might happen to temperature change. Probably the red one is no longer supported by the data, and probably the yellow one is probably too conservative. So the truth is probably somewhere in between those two lines for temperature change by the end of the century. Another figure that I like to put up just to get people warmed up is what would it actually take to hold temperature change to 2 degrees. The black line here is actual emissions, and then you have a bunch of ways that global emissions would have to decline. And this is kind of the genesis or the basis for a lot of the target-based approaches that people have. And I stare at that, and like I spend most of my professional life with data. Data doesn't often look like this, so I think it would be quite extraordinary change. So what I'm going to argue is that the reason that the social cost of carbon is so important is that rather than kind of using these target-based approaches, and Maureen hit upon this earlier, an alternative is to compare the costs and the benefits of different climate policies. And you know, just to set the record straight, the way I think of, and I think the common way of, the social cost of carbon is it's just the monetary value of the damages associated with the release of an additional ton of CO2, monetary value of all damages, things that for which there's market prices and things for which there are not often direct market prices. So a whole range of policies actions involve the release of CO2, and that's going to change the atmosphere and temperatures for centuries. And to know how to balance the costs and benefits of that, it's critical to know this value, which is the social cost of carbon. You know, one thing I'll say before I turn to Bill, who helped set us off all on this journey, is I think every policy that you could ever think of beyond, I guess, the UN setting climate policy is a marginal policy. So sometimes there are concerns about the social cost of carbon telling you marginal values. I actually think that's the right way to think of even if the US were to have its emissions, that would still be marginal relative, maybe relative to annual emissions and certainly relative to the stock of CO2 in the atmosphere. What I'm going to argue here is that Bill helped set out this foundation I think he'll agree with this. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. Much of this was done before there were modern computers and data for a lot of things. And then a lot of people have brought different things to hang off of this. And what I'm going to argue is that we're now at the point where we can start to bring data and computing power to bear on kind of fleshing out this way of thinking about climate change and its damages. And so that's a window through which I think you can view what I'm going to talk a lot of, what I'm going to spend most of my time talking about. So this is where there's a lot of repetition with what Maureen was suggesting, but this is just repeating that what the social cost of carbon is just the damages associated with the release of an additional ton, which will feed through temperature into our well-being. Given the absence of legislation in the United States, effectively, the cost-benefit analysis and the regulatory channel are the only avenue that's available in the United States to doing things about climate change. And cost-benefit analysis in the United States doing regulations requires cost-benefit analysis, and that requires placing a value on the reduction in a ton of CO2. And in fact, when I was in the Obama administration, this was a point, there was not a coherent social cost of carbon, and my suggestion was that there be one because it seemed like we were ginning up to have regulations that would have a very unfair fight, which is dollars of damages would be compared to tons of CO2, and I think dollars always win, and so you have to have a way to put things on the same playing field. And this is some of the history of the social cost of carbon in the U.S., which Maureen has covered earlier. You know, just to belabor the point, the U.S. has this wide set of very inconsistent and small policies. With what the social cost of carbon can do is help figure out which ones are effective, that is, where the benefits exceed the costs. Not just because it says climate in front of a policy or regulation does not mean that it's a desirable policy. And you know, for different values of social cost of carbon, different policies would look more or less appealing. You can also use the social cost of carbon to estimate what are the total global damages that we're producing alongside GDP every year. And you can just see that the value one uses obviously is going to have great influence on what the total climate damages are. Okay, so this is where we're going to get to the meat of what we're trying to do, and Maureen highlighted this. This is, I think there are, the last several years or decades have produced opportunities to make great advances on our understanding of these main inputs into the social cost of carbon. And then one thing I'm going to keep coming back to is, or I would say in the early days, but out of the gates, I think now where we can begin to characterize the uncertainty associated with our understanding of climate change. And you know, that uncertainty arises from the climate, I like to say the climate scientists' fault. They can't figure out how much a doubling of CO2 will do to temperature. They have some distribution. It comes from the economists' fault for failing to be able to say in a point estimate way, how big the damages are, that we're gonna have some distribution around that. And then you have to make these very heroic projections about what's gonna happen to the economy over many decades and even centuries and population growth. But if you could begin to characterize that, you could move from a world where you're effectively assuming away that uncertainty and or assuming that people are risk neutral, and allowing for the fact that they're risk averse and finding a way to value that uncertainty in and of itself. And I think that is a additional step forward that can be done. So, you know, here are the damage functions that came out of, that were underlie the US government's social cost of carbon from Bill's DICE model and the PAGE model and the FUND model. And as Maureen highlighted earlier, almost all of, and there's been some updating to be fair, but most of the kind of foundational evidence of that, the papers that underlie it, are kind of all from the, largely from the 90s and the early 2000s. And what that has missed is an explosion of research that has made, I think, a lot of progress, facilitated by access to data and facilitated by more powerful computers to try and understand what damages from climate change will be. And so this is one area where there's lots of opportunity. Maureen highlighted that, obviously a gremlin came in and put the same slides in mine and Maureen's deck, that there are opportunities for relying on more up-to-date climate models. One area in which I think there is a lot of opportunity too is where I think we have failed is in talking about global GDP changing by 2% or 3%, and or global temperatures changing by 2 degrees C or something like that. That's not, nobody lives at the mean. And so I think picking that apart and being able to say something about how unequal or how that vary or the heterogeneity of that around the world, I think is another opportunity. And I'll tell you some what we've been doing at the Climate Impact Lab about that. So all of this is kind of prelude for with my friends Trevor Hauser, Solomon Shung, and Bob Kopp. Bob is, if you have any tough questions about climate models, I'll just hide behind Bob and say that he's an expert. Created this Climate Impact Lab, whose goal was to try and take this body that was built and flesh it out as much as possible with data, and I'm going to try and talk about how we do that. And what we tried to do is have a couple principles that we adhered to is, and this is very much a continuing work in progress, is use the best available empirical evidence, use the best available climate models. These are a little bit like, do you love your mother? Yes, we want to have the best available evidence. Importantly, we want the data to be globally representative and the damages to be globally representative. Important to account for adaptation benefits and costs, and then to value uncertainty and the unequal impacts or heterogeneity. And so for this, we have come up with our own name, and it's not an especially good name. We're taking suggestions if you have a better one than DSIM, but that's what we have so far. Okay, so what do we actually do? Why don't I try and, so the first thing I just want to highlight is what the data, the advances in access to data and computing power have allowed us to do is rather than say something about what's going to happen in, for the world on average or for 16 regions or even for at the country level, we're able to divide the world into almost 25,000 regions and make predictions about what's going to happen in each of those regions. In the case of France, in the United States, they're like a county. In France, they correspond to departments. So there's, we have estimates for all 96 French departments, and it allows us to do that. A second thing, and I'll keep coming back to this, that we try to do is really account for, and you know, if you just stare at this for a second, it's a pretty astonishing amount of wide distributions on what we understand about what could happen to, this is a change in global mean temperatures. And so, you know, if you have probability mass here, admittedly, this is pretty far out, that's when, you know, those are, you could call those climate disasters are potentially laying out there depending on the shape of the damage function. And so you can see that even some probability mass out here could really alter the calculation of the impact of putting up an additional ton of CO2, which will stay in, up in the atmosphere for several hundred years. Another thing that I just want to draw your attention to that comes out of the use of this highly disaggregated data is how different the responses, so we have these 24,000 regions here, What I've done here is just picked out two regions. We're going to call them orange, that's Oslo, and I guess that's green for Accra, and then the global average. And so this is the damage, this is the relationship between annual mortality and daily temperature realizations. That's, and for the globe, it's this kind of blackish line. But what I want you to pay attention to is how different it is in different parts of the world. And this comes out, and you'll see more about how we estimated this, but for the time being, just take my word that this comes from estimation, it comes from data, is here's the shape in Oslo. And so you can see there's these very cold days where they have probability mass on currently, and they're very, very damaging. And they just don't have a lot of days where temperatures get hot. Accra, on the other hand, has lots of days and is going to get many more where it's greater than 30. And they have, because they're so poor, they have this very, very sharp shape to their response function. And so you can see how the same global change in temperature could lead to very, very different impacts depending on where you are in the world. And that in some respects, the global average is kind of uninteresting. Okay. Let's see if I can make this slide. Okay, so what we try to do is bring this style of approach, and to this point, we've only done it for five sectors, for mortality, agriculture, energy, labor, think of this as labor supply, and not labor productivity, and coastal damages. Those are the five sectors that we've developed empirical estimates of the damages of climate change from. And then we're going to try and pull it all together in what we're calling our integration paper. We're continuing to work on other sectors, but this is why I mean it's a work in progress. And at this point, we have five of them done and feeding into what I'm going to call the integration paper. Okay, so how do we go about doing this? I'm a little, it sounds like an academic talking to say, well, there's only six easy steps, we're going to march through all six easy steps here, and I hope you'll be patient. So the first is, it's a little pedestrian, but super important, actually getting data from around the world, not just getting data of convenience. So I had written papers about what the impacts of climate change would be on mortality in the United States. Well, the United States is just a small portion of global population. And so what we have tried to do is collect data sector by sector for the world. And so energy was pretty easy to get. It took some doing, but we were able to get data from almost all parts of the world. Here's the mortality data. You can see the places in the world that we have data and the places that we don't. And I'm going to show you how we try and fill in for the places that we don't as we go along. Here's agriculture. Here's labor. Here's some data on coastal exposure. And so the first step, it was to collect all of this data. Then the second step is to try to estimate the impact of temperature change on, or temperature on each of those sectors, and doing that one by one in a separate paper. And the first step, part of that, is to estimate the impact, the random variation of short-run temperature changes, and then I'm going to show you how we see how that varies, or people are able to adapt based on long-run characteristics of where they live. And so this is just the relationship between temperature and mortality globally. For those over 65, we have separate data for that. For those 5 to 64, and those less than 5. The main thing I just want you to take away from it is we were able to use this. We had this data. We were able to do this for all those countries that you saw. The second insight is, well, that's fine, but using year-to-year weather variation does not tell you about climate change. And the second insight is, well, maybe the shape of that response function changes based on some long-run characteristics of the places. And so we wanted to develop as big a set of them as we could. The two, that there was a theoretical basis for, and which there could plausibly be projections going into the future, were income and climate. And so the idea being that that effect of weather could be mediated by the effect of climate and the effect of income. So just to be super precise about it, if you take Houston and Seattle in the United States, Houston gets tons and tons of hot days a year. The question we're asking here with, from the data is it, and Seattle gets almost no hot days a year. When a hot day arrives in Seattle versus Houston, is there a different impact on mortality? And then the same thing you can imagine doing an exercise comparing a similar climate in a rich country versus a poor country. And so this is one way to illustrate what emerges from that data. So this is the effect of moving a day from 20 degrees C to 35 degrees C by deciles of climate. And so let me just start with, here's the coldest decile. You can see this is the very northern parts of the Earth. If you take a day from 20 degrees and switch it to 35, you would increase the mortality rate for those over 65 by about somewhere between 15 and 20 per 100,000 per year. Now, what was really someone who uses data a lot in their life, I often joke, but it's true, data is like the most disappointing friend you ever had. And this is one of those rare instances where data was not disappointing. And so as you go to a warmer place, you can see the warmer regions of the world who have more experience with hot days, the effect of hot day, the same hot day starts to go down and just progressively goes down and down as you get to hotter and hotter places. And so the way to say it is, in a relatively hot place, so that's these places that are used to very high temperatures, one of those hot days doesn't do as much to mortality rates as if one of those days arrived on a in a relatively cold place. It's straightforward, but we think of that as adaptation. And I want you to think forward. We're going to want to project adaptation in the future. And so, in fact, why do we need this relationship? So as the world gets warmer, we're going to want to allow that response function to evolve over time in a given place, even if it's very, very, very convex right now. Okay, here's just to illustrate the role of income. This blew my mind, and I think this was like a total blind spot because the usual problem that it's easy to collect data from rich temperate places. So here's the relationship between daily temperatures and energy consumption, or I guess this is electricity consumption, and this is the familiar U-shape we're all used to seeing. But now what I'm going to show you is deciles of the world, deciles defined by GDP. So this is the richest decile. This is the next richest decile. And what you can already see is, like, even as you move four deciles in, that relation, that U, starts to go away. We were wondering about that. That was interesting. And then what happens if you go to the, like, bottom six? There's like no relationship between energy consumption and hot and cold days. So what is that data trying to say there? That's saying these guys are too poor to turn on the heat when it gets cold and turn on the air conditioning when it gets hot. There's literally no relationship. And so if you're going to project forward what the impacts of climate change are going to be on energy consumption, you have to take account of where countries stand in these deciles. And so here's just some how countries have moved between 71 and 2012. The United States moves from the 10th, 9th to the 10th decile, and you can see the analogous thing for other countries. And then here are the projections that we're going to use later of how rich these guys are going to be. And so even Ethiopia, by the end of the century, is still going to be in a decile where if you take the data seriously, they're not going to be able to respond when hot temperatures arrive. Here's just some evidence, what we got from the labor sector, which is that when hot temperatures arrive, it is true people are willing to work less, but that's all concentrated, it appears like it's all concentrated among high-risk workers, and high-risk we defined as people who basically don't sit inside an office all day with temperature control. And you can see how the fraction of high risk goes down as countries get richer, and so that's something that we're going to want to account for. In agriculture, there's three sources of adaptation: the temperature, GDP, and irrigation. Irrigation is important there, it's not for the other sectors. And here too, you can see how there's heterogeneity in the response depending on where people are in the world. And I'm just gonna keep coming back that there's this enormous heterogeneity that we're uncovering, and we're gonna be able to project into these almost 25,000 regions. Okay, so now one thing about doing all this is you can easily capture the benefits of adaptation, but that's not enough. You also have to be able to recover the costs. And we think people will undertake adaptations for the benefits exceed the costs, but we needed to develop a method to do that. And so why? Because the full value of climate impacts is going to be this direct effect, which is the effect of temperature changes, plus whatever the change in adaptation costs that people are will have undertaken. And I'm just going to put this up, and then I'll talk in the background. These are equations taken from our mortality paper and probably a little out of context. But the basic idea is that we're using a revealed preference approach where, since we can see the benefits of adaptation, that is, being in a warmer place, how much less mortality is there than if you were in a colder place, and we're calling that the benefits of adaptation, well, people should undertake that adaptation up until the point where the benefits equal the cost. And so if you can figure out that point, then you can kind of trace out what the costs are by seeing how marginal changes in the climate affect the degree of adaptation that people are undertaking. And so we use that to back out the costs, and then having that, we can then get a full measure of the value of climate impacts, which are going to be these direct effects. And these betas, of course, are endogenously chosen. And then adding on to that, the costs of having a different beta. And so that is a different response, mortality response to temperature. And so we do this differently across the different sectors. And this is just a little summary of that. Okay, so then having done that, estimated the direct impacts, estimated how that's mediated by climate and income, and inferred the costs of that adaptation, what we can try to do is project that around the world. And so let me just start with, I'm not doing this going forward, we're just saying this is today. Remember, these are the places we had mortality data, so where we can directly estimate the damages of temperature. And then, but we don't have that data for all these other parts of the world. So what are we going to do? Well, if we know those parts of the world's income and we know their climate, we can then project what the mortality responsiveness to temperature will be. And so that's what we do. And then you can see we can fill in the whole world. And so now what we've done is we've taken a good portion of the world that was in darkness, and now we actually have projections for the entire world using this, what I'm going to call as a two-factor model in the case of mortality. This is something that came up at lunch in my discussion with Bill, who was asking, basically, do we have coverage of, where is there support in the data for this exercise? And so the gray areas are, you can see on the horizontal axis, annual average temperature and GDP per capita. Okay, and so that's where people, the gray areas are where people are today. The orange is where we actually have data. And so you can see, we're not doing so great, and so we're going to have to use functional form to extrapolate to places that are pretty poor and pretty hot. We have some coverage there in the hot places, but not down to the lowest levels of income, so we're going to have to use functional form to extrapolate to there. But what's kind of interesting is, well, the world is going to be changing, and it's going to be getting hotter and richer. And this is where the data, we project where what it'll look like at the end of the century. And for the end of the century, you can see we actually have pretty good coverage based on today's data. And so we'll be relying much less on functional form. Okay, so just so you can see the value of income growth and adaptation to climate, here is what the impact of an additional one of these days greater than 35 is for the over 65 category of people currently. And now I'm just going to zoom forward, allowing income and climate to progress. I went from 2020 to 2050. You can see it's getting lighter. That's because people are getting richer and they're where they live is getting hotter, so they're becoming more effective at dealing with it. And here's 2080, and there's 2100. So that's what that's producing for making projections, filling into parts of the world we don't have today, and then projecting forward. All coming from that estimation, in this case, of the relationship between mortality and temperature, interacted with climate and income. When you add it all together, I think you get this very striking finding that if you had shut down adaptation and shut down income growth and just let temperature change, you would have this massive increase in mortality rates by the end of the century. If you add back in now the fact that when people get richer, they're better able to protect themselves, that would greatly shrink it. If you add in the additional impact of adapting to climate change, then that would move it down to the green one, and then it would pop it back up if you include the costs of adaptation. So basically, compared to a no adaptation world, what we're finding is the costs are about a third of what they would be if you had ignored adaptation and ignored the growth in income. And I'm gonna keep coming back to this, particularly at the end. I wanna emphasize we don't actually know that with certainty. There's a lot of uncertainty around that. And so what are the sources of uncertainty? Well, we have 33 climate models, and we have, we have climate uncertainty and econometric uncertainty from the estimation of those equations. And when you pull all that together, you actually get this range of estimates. And now the point I'm gonna make here is the way that people have proceeded before they were able to characterize this uncertainty is to assume effectively that people were risk neutral and that this uncertainty in and of itself wasn't worth something. And I'm going to talk about that at the end, about how we try to value that uncertainty. And that was for mortality. Of course, there's uncertainty in every sector. This is for electricity, other fuels, sea level rise, labor supply. And agriculture, which those are we're not showing the uncertainty there, but we could. This is another figure I'm gonna come back to at the end. Now remember, I got these 25,000 regions. I can make projections for each of those 25,000 regions. And I just wanna highlight how different the impacts are in different parts of the world. So let's go to Oslo. Oslo is gonna do awesome with respect to mortality by the end of the century. Why? Because they got all those cold days and they're gonna move down that curve and get rid of those cold days. And so you have this big reduction. It admittedly, it's uncertain and there's a distribution around that. Accra is almost like the mirror image. It's a poor and hot place to begin with. And you're gonna get this very large increase in mortality rates. Of course, also with some uncertainty around it. Okay, and so that's how the impacts are distributed globally for mortality. This is for electricity consumption. Everyone is going to use fewer heating fuels as the world warms. And here's some of the other sectors. This is kind of for fun. We can separate, in the case of mortality, we can separate the direct impacts, the additional mortality, and how much people will spend on adapting. And what you can see is, to a first approximation, poor countries are gonna have a lot of extra deaths and rich countries are gonna spend money, which is kind of fits people's intuition, but this is something that comes out of the data. I'm just going to go to that. Okay, so now we've got that sector by sector, and we can then estimate empirical damage functions going back to those original damage functions that were all sector, effectively all sector damage functions from Dice, Page, and Fund, and try to use them to calculate sector-specific social costs of carbon. So like, what is an extra ton worth in mortality impacts converted in to dollars? And so here, what I've done is, I'm gonna show you some vertical, you'll see these vertical columns, and they will be, there'll be 66 of them, combinations of emission scenarios, and emission scenarios will be RCP 4.5 and RCP 8.5, and climate models. And the interaction of those two, or the cross of those two, will produce a change in global mean temperatures. And so here's when I just got the 4.5 guys. And then why are there any variation within a column? There's any variation in a column in this case because of the econometric uncertainty associated with the damages of that change in GMST. And then now I can add in RCP 8.5. And so what's kind of neat now is I've got damages, this is for just for mortality, in trillions of dollars. I went from bodies or deaths to dollars by using the value of statistical life. And you could try to fit a damage function through all those points. And so that's what I'm gonna do here. And there's some uncertainty associated with that damage function as well. And this is, these are kind of our core mortality damage function results. We can do the same thing for each sector, do it for coastal, for labor, agriculture. This is denoted in yields or calories, so they go down, yield, same thing as yields, electricity, and other fuels. Okay, so for each of those sectors, we can also, you know, for those of you who like geeking out on figures, this is one of my favorites. Here, what we're gonna do is four panels that I think will totally summarize how we can get a sector-specific social cost of carbon. So here, we're gonna shoot up a pulse of CO2. You can see it going right up as if it happened today. Then we're gonna ask, well, what happens to CO2 concentrations as a result of that pulse? And this is something Christian and I talked about at lunch. It shoots up, and then there's this interplay with the oceans about how much the oceans are taking in and when they're releasing it. And so it goes down for a while, and then actually goes, strangely, goes up for a while. I quizzed Bob Kopp about this, but he swears it, that's what the models say. Then that pulse can be converted into a change in temperature. And finally, that change in temperature, year by year, can be converted into mortality impacts. And I think this is the, these have been discounted. But you can see these are the year by year mortality impacts of that additional ton of CO2. Okay, and so that builds out our sector specific estimates of the social cost of carbon. I'll just note, using data and trying to have data from around the world is kind of is a really big game changer. Effectively, because we only had data from moderate rich countries, we thought that the mortality impacts of climate change were going to be effectively zero. That's a gray bar. We find this a very large estimate using this kind of more robust data or more comprehensive data. Actually, we find that energy consumption will go down on net. That's different than what people had thought previously. There's not labor disutility before, and the ag results are a little different. So sector by sector, this is changing our understanding of what climate change does. Okay, so then the next step is, we now have produced this sector by sector. The next step is how to convert that into a full social cost of carbon that encompasses all of those sectors. I just want to point, and this work comes to the work that some of the people in this room have done, This is going to require making choices about how to measure welfare. So the one thing you're going to take account of is, well, how to think about the value of just that uncertainty produced by climate change. There's important questions about whether or not a loss of a dollar to Jeff Bezos is the same as a loss of a dollar to a poor person in India. And then there's important questions about how to discount that stream of damages under uncertain economic growth, uncertainty about climate change, and then the notorious climate beta. And so that is a correlation between those two. But I'm just going to remind you, we have these probabilistic high-resolution climate damage estimates that we're using to fill out these parts of the literature that has evolved in the last several decades, or make concrete, or implement, maybe is a way to say it. So this is just to remind you, we're going to have our estimates of damages are going to be location and sector specific exposure and vulnerability. We're going to have statistical uncertainty in damages. We're going to have from the estimation, the econometric estimation, we're going to have emissions growth and population uncertainty. Maureen talked about that and RFF's important efforts to produce estimates of that. And then, of course, we're going to have uncertainty due to, and since I think we're primarily economists here, we can make fun of the climate scientists and say, due to the climate scientists' failings to get us to understand better what a ton of CO2 will do. So I'm just going to say that the standard calculation, certainly the one that the U.S. government has done in the past, is one that has effectively assumed away the value of that uncertainty by assuming risk neutrality. It has added up unweighted dollar values of damages across regions, assuming that the marginal utility of consumption is constant, and it has used constant discount rates. And that picks up the discussion this morning highlights that is an unappealing feature. So we think now, having produced this empirically founded, let's call it zoo or foundation, we can make progress on all of these things. And we're going to do that by allowing for some risk aversion, allowing for declining marginal utility consumption, and this endogenous discounting. So let me start by saying, if you had constant discounting and a RCP 4.5, that's a less, it's a somewhat moderate climate emissions trajectory, and RCP 7.0 is probably kind of what the world is on right now, and you ignored the uncertainty or assumed risk neutrality, you would end up with a social cost of carbon of about $89 with RCP 4.5 and $174 with RCP 7.0. This is not moving all the way to, I'm going to get there where probably Christian would prefer that we got, but I'm just going to try and build in pieces and just say, well, this is like kind of a basic intermediate micro graph of that people dislike risk and they might be willing to pay something to get rid of it. So this is like the standard graph. Let me now, remember, I can do this region by region. For all 25,000 regions of the world. So of course I chose Chicago. Here is where GDP per capita is projected to be. Is that right? Yeah, it's about $155,000 at the end of the century for the average person in the US. That's the horizontal green line. And then what I'm gonna report is what would GDP per capita be? The pink guy is assuming climate changes in climate of GMST, that is global mean temperature, of 2 degrees, 4 degrees, 6 degrees, 8 degrees. And you can see actually Chicago's got nasty winters, so a little warming is probably beneficial on net to Chicago. And then the green guys start to go, sorry, let's focus on the pink guys for now, start to go down as it gets hotter and hotter. But what I want you to see is that, now I want to remind you of that uncertainty in each of those estimates, and so we can calculate the certainty equivalent consumption across all those climate draws that I had. And you can see at the higher temperatures, that uncertainty is starting to build a wedge between, I guess we'll call that the salmon or pink, and the green. And so it's not just that climate is bad at very high temperatures and that it reduces consumption, the uncertainty is make it one step further. So that's maybe a long, okay, fine, I explained it. Philippe nodded his head. In Khartoum, that's even larger than it is in Chicago, the deviation between the pink and the green. And here is what the risk premium or the certainty equivalent is worth in different parts of the world for each of our 25,000 regions. And so now that was all big warm up to say, without going to the proper form of discount, it's coming in a second, if you just add it, that there could be some risk aversion, and so here we're providing the technical details on that, you can make the social cost of carbon go up by quite a bit. In RCP 4.5, it would increase it by, like, say, roughly 50%. In RCP 7.0, you would actually double it. Okay, so let me pause. This is just a long-winded way of saying the uncertainty in and of itself associated with climate damages is something that we have not paid quantitative attention to in developing estimates of social cost of carbon, and it's meaningful. Now, what happens if we take the next step and really go all the way to endogenous discounting? And this is going to account for the elusive climate beta, and all of you may have, and so remember, the uncertainty that I'm bringing to bear here is the uncertainty in the socioeconomic scenario, the uncertainty in the climate models, and the uncertainty in the econometric estimation. And what I want you to think about here is the climate beta, you might have intuition it goes one way. I actually think when you think hard about it, it's unclear which direction it goes, in the sense that if we're doing really well, so the economy is really booming, there's going to be very large climate damages, but that's just a function of the fact that we're rich. And so we're going to want to assign a relatively high discount rate to that, and that's what the endogenous discounting would do. On the other hand, due to the convexities in the damage function, if we get lots and lots of damages, and that happens to be arriving because we got a bad a combination of that and a bad climate draw, those are periods that you're going to want to put a very low discount rate on, or weight up, I guess you would say. And so when you add all that together, what you can end up with using kind of Ramsey-style endogenous discounting are these estimates of the social cost of carbon. And then, and so this has been a kind of not very nuanced version of socioeconomic uncertainty. And so now we'll add to that by swapping that out for using the RFF distributions of socioeconomic uncertainty that Maureen talked about. And when you do that, you end up with a social cost of carbon of about $190. I saw Bill taking a picture. I'm just gonna note for him and everyone else, these are preliminary results. Our integration work is going on in real time. But what I take away from this is we now have the beginnings of an empirically founded social cost carbon that pulls along a lot of the important theoretical insights that the literature has been constructing over time. Okay, and so let me just add with all the things, end with all the things that are missing, and they're not small. So the first is, I'm just bringing back up this mortality impacts figure. And I just, so like, what's the obvious solution like there's billions of people in the red regions. It's going to become super unpleasant to live there. Well, they should just all move to Canada and they should just all move to Russia. And what we're missing, of course, is that while there will be forces for migration, it's going to be very, very costly. And political systems are not designed for that kind of change. And so that's certainly something that's missing. So there's a series of things that are missing: migration and trade, endogenous sectoral reallocation, the endogenous economic growth that is not something that's inside there, our current estimates. We have adaptation occurring and innovation occurring, but we don't have climate-biased innovation occurring because that's not in the historical record. And so that's something that one could add. There's tipping points. There's a lot of other sectors that we're working on adding to this exercise. So those are some of the important things that are missing. Why don't I stop there and be close to on time? Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mike. Congratulations. Yeah. Yes, thank you.